What's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. I'm Jamie Dodd. Thomas Drance is my co-host. He covers the team for The Athletic as well. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And this hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. You need forklifts that perform under pressure and pallet racking that maximizes your space. Visit them online at racksteel.com. What's going on, Drance?
Would you say, what would you say has more composure? The Edmonton Oilers last night.
Okay.
The Edmonton Oilers last night, or the 650 inbox after Mark Spector calls the city a bunch of crybabies with a losing culture.
I think our inbox
say shows more.
I think our inbox, to be perfectly honest.
I agree with you. At the very least, our inbox isn't, you know, reduced to eight men on the bench like it's a beer league game.
Oh, no, they,
at least
they
our
show
inbox
up.
Isn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least our inbox isn't spraying water. You know, it rains enough in Vancouver. No one would waste water in such a fashion. You can tell that Jake Walman's never lived here. I thought that was a pretty abysmal showing from the Edmonton Oilers in terms of just absolutely like walking into this trap that the Florida Panthers set for everybody. They wear you down with their pressure game, and then they dance on your grave, and they hit you hard. But you can't, like, the Oilers can't win playing that style of hockey against this team.
No.
Right? Even in terms of trying to take a pound of flesh at the end of a blowout game, gooning it up, like, you know who's going to be better at that than the Oilers are? The Panthers, if it ever comes about. And it probably will at some point in the series. I don't think the Oilers are on the ropes. I don't think it's that dramatic. Every time we see this Oilers team get blown out and embarrassed, they put together massive win streaks. We saw it with their, what, six-game win streak after the 6-2 loss to LA in the first round. Like, we know what this looks like. We know that this team's not going to conduct themselves that way necessarily again. But, man, they completely fell into the trap that the Panthers set for the Carolina Hurricanes previously and the Toronto Maple Leafs before that and the Tampa Bay Lightning before that and just about every team in the league at this point. They do it better than anyone else. And if these games look like that, the Florida Panthers will be Stanley Cup champions.
And
no doubt about that.
We'll talk more about the series with Landon Ferraro coming up at 1 o'clock. Also, Tristan Nielsen's going to join the show. Abbotsford Canucks forward. Looking forward to chatting with him at 1:30. But we got an open hour to start things off. And yeah, obviously, I mean, we can continue to dive into the game three results. 6-1 is the final. Florida takes a 2-1 series lead. I mean, I'll disagree with you a little bit. Like, Edmonton is kind of on the ropes here. Not, I'm not saying it's series over or they can't recover their composure or anything like that, but now all of a sudden, you know, Florida's got a chance to win a game at home and take a 3-1 stranglehold on the series. Game four will be Thursday in Edmonton. So that game four becomes absolutely massive now for Edmonton. And I'm not going to say, well, it's hard to see them winning three in a row against Florida because they did it last year in the Stanley Cup final and came just short of winning four in a row to complete the comeback. So, you know, even if Florida wins on Thursday, it's not game over just yet, but it's a massive game. It is an absolutely massive game coming up on Thursday for the Oilers and for the Panthers, obviously. And really, I mean, that was just total domination from Florida. And I think naturally a lot of people are going to remember from that. Like, it's going to be remembered as the gong show game of these Stanley Cup finals, right? Especially after the first incredibly entertaining and, you know, tight two games, and then this one turns into a blowout and it's all about the shenanigans, and we can talk about that. But I think what was just as important was what Florida did in the second period in the only run of 5-on-5 hockey we got in that game, and they dominated. And that was when the game was still in the balance, right? And it was a one-goal game after Edmonton scored on the power play early in that period. And then I thought Florida really just took over, and it was their forecheck winning again, but they also started to make a ton of plays in the neutral zone. They started to generate rush scoring chances, and they were just all over Edmonton. And I think that, to me, is maybe the more concerning element for Edmonton coming out of last night than them coming unraveled and losing their composure in the third period. Because I think that's going to happen, and I'm not buying, like, oh, now they're in their heads and they're not going to be – like, they could absolutely easily win game four. You know, all it takes is incredible Connor McDavid goal, and then Florida's chasing the game, and then no one's thinking about the third period. So I think the more concerning thing for me is the fact that when the game was still in the balance, when it was still close, Florida took over in the second period.
Well, and Florida has taken over every single second period. Once you have the long change in combination with their stress game, I mean, they're going two for one. Two shot attempts for every shot attempt. The Oilers are getting two goals. They've outscored the Oilers 5-2 in second periods to this point. I mean, it's sort of shaped all three of the games in this series. You remove the second period and the Oilers are, you know, probably have a slight edge in terms of the run of play. But with the second period included, I mean, this Panthers team has a massive, massive edge. So I don't know what the Oilers' answer is, but they need to find a way to hold the fort and be an awful lot better in the second. The other area of concern is how many shots from premium scoring areas did Verhaeghe and Reinhart either miss the net or like not get a shot off or just like need to do better in games one and two. And the Oilers still, you know, squeaked out one win with a comeback and then needed a miracle comeback to even force overtime. Last night, those guys hit some regression, effectively. They made their shots in a way they hadn't, you know, earlier in the series. And frankly, if we're being honest, for much of this playoffs, it's not like we've seen Verhaeghe and Reinhart, you know, absolutely rip teams' hearts out with their finishing ability game in, game out. And yet, you know what? They have the ability to do so. Like, those guys can do it. And so I sort of look at that, too, and just think, man, if the Panthers are making their shots, if their defense is holding up the way it did, you know, Gustav Forsling is negating all these McDavid rush chances with brilliance, just brilliant defensive form. And, you know, the Oilers are getting frustrated here. They're in for a long series. So look, a big win for the Panthers, the edge, definitely the initiative definitely goes to them. That second period thing, I think, is a huge storyline to monitor going into game four. And I'm thrilled to have a chance to watch the Oilers try to rebound from that. Again, we know this team well enough to know that they can, but there's a lot to atone for given their performance on Monday evening.
Yeah, the point about the shooters being wasteful on Florida, I think especially in game one, that was a major element of it for me. I think Verhaeghe in game one, I don't have it in front of me, but had something like 5 shot attempts and no shots on goal. Like, it was just missed, or he was thrown into guys' shin pads, or he didn't get a shot off even in the situation. Like, it wasn't a good performance for him. Several of them were in really dangerous areas as well. And then you see what he does on that power play goal last night, and it's like, oh, right, he's a really, really good shooter. We obviously know what Sam Reinhart can do as well. And I know Paul Maurice said last night, like, hey, he's back to full health. So that's a very, very scary consideration for the Edmonton Oilers as well. And then, of course, you know, Sam Bennett and Brad Marchand just keep on doing their thing. And I think generally, you know, the reaction around the league that I've seen and from fans and listeners in our inbox coming out of last night's game, you know, one is just about like, man, Florida is so good at getting under your skin, baiting you into these moments where they can take advantage. And it really is incredible because they weren't even really the aggressor when it all unraveled last night, right? It was Edmonton losing their composure and going after them. And so we get back into this like, well, you need to be the big physical team in the playoffs to win. Now, Edmonton's a really big physical team as well, but I understand why that, you know, perennial talking point is back in a big way after it. I have a bit of a different takeaway, though, from watching that game. I was watching the game and I was trying to think, like, which member of the Vancouver Canucks would thrive in this game? And now, obviously, Quinn Hughes, you can put him in any type of game. He's going to be great. But beyond that,
Jonah Gadjevich.
Well, he's no longer a member of the Canucks, but sure.
Not Vasily Podkolzin.
No. But, like, which member of the current Vancouver Canucks would thrive in that game? And other than Quinn Hughes, the guy who was top of mind for me was Connor Garland. Like, I think Connor Garland would have loved to play in that game and could have been really, really effective. Like, you're telling me if Connor Garland was in the Evan Rodriguez slot on Florida that he wouldn't fit in seamlessly and be causing havoc in the crease, constantly under guys' skin, lifting sticks on the forecheck, you know, going to the dirty areas, laughing in Darnell Nurse's face or something after he gives him a crosscheck after the whistle? And I'm not discounting the importance of size in the playoffs, but as I was thinking through this, it's like, I think we constantly focus on just the size factor to the exclusion of the mentality factor, right? And even like Sam Bennett's a beast, don't get me wrong, but if you're just looking at pure physical measurements. It's not like he's way outside of the norm for the NHL. What is he, like 6'1"?
Do a pull up.
Yeah.
At 18.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like he's strong. Don't get me wrong. He can lay big hits, but it's not like it's like, oh, he's so big, no one else can stand up to him. No, it's because he's got the mentality. He's got that dog in him. And I think, again, I'm not saying you don't need to have the big guys as well who can really handle their business and do all of that. You do. But when we do this, like, well, who should the Canucks acquire? Who should they go after? Ah, Marco Rossi, he's too small. Or, ah, this guy, you know, he's only 5'11". Are they going to have fun in a game like that? Are they going to compete and love competing in a game like that? That's the much more important consideration to me than are they 5'11 or are they 6'1"? And I think Connor Garland would have had a blast competing in that game last night.
Yeah, and I also think don't ignore the quality. Like, don't ascribe solely the Panthers' success to style and ignore the quality of their players.
Yeah.
Right? Brad Marchand is, you know, an X factor for that team, not solely because he knows the game within a game, but because his feet are still at a high enough level that he can make, you know, a real middle six impact, even against a team like the Oilers, when they throw their fastball, right? He's still not out of place, right? Itu Lusterainen is a horse defensively, but also, you know, on a lot of teams might be tasked with playing top line, second line, being like in the Val Nichushkin role or the Zach Hyman role on the high end on most teams in this league. Lundell would be probably Vancouver's best center, given Pettersson's form this past year, right? Like, if Lundell had been in Vancouver all year, we would be talking in this market about how he's this team's number one center going into next season. That's just the truth of the matter. And then you get to Bennett, and it's like, yeah, that hit on Podkolzin, and then the hit on Klingberg.
Yeah.
You know, obviously is incredible signature stuff from a guy who's elevated his game and is playing black and blue hockey the way it should be played in the Stanley Cup playoffs. And what I'm about to say takes absolutely nothing away from the importance that he's had as a result of, you know, his cynicism, his mastery of the dark arts of the game within a game, and his, you know, physical assertiveness. But Sam Bennett's biggest impact on this series is as a puck carrier through the neutral zone. And it was, again, on that play, right? Like, he was the guy with the burst through the neutral zone who the other Florida Panthers player was able to pass it off to, so that, you know, what could have been a two-on-one if Bennett didn't have the legs that he had, instead became a breakaway, and he made no mistake on the finish. You know, Bennett has been a key driver offensively for the Florida Panthers, especially in this series. I mean, how many entries are you watching where it's Lundell skating past an Oilers defender? Zero. Kachuk, zero. Barkov, zero. Not to say that those guys aren't doing enough, but in terms of having that push, in terms of the reason why this game or this series is not looking like that the Dallas Stars-Edmonton series, where it looked like Dallas was playing half-court basketball and the Oilers were the Showtime Lakers, is that Bennett's brought some showtime of his own. So we should focus on the physical play. We should focus on the mentality, but let's not ignore too, like, Bennett is showing you his offensive quality.
Mm-hmm.
And without that, he'd be far more limited, right? Without the ability to skate and carry the puck through the neutral zone and actually drive for his line, especially, you know, in that area of the ice, he wouldn't be a guy that we'd look at and be like, yeah, I wouldn't sniff at 9.5, 10 million. Sure. That sounds fine. Because it does. And that's a testament to his quality as a player. So as much as the goonery dominated the game in terms of the visuals that we saw and in terms of the storyline, the Oilers got beat in the alley and on the scoreboard, you know, that as much as that stuff matters and is something we should focus on, and, you know, is something it's fair to say the Canucks don't have at an acceptable level, given the current composition of this roster, especially not for this time of year. Like, as much as that's all fair and true, don't ignore that quality comes first. The Panthers are able to do this, are able to frustrate the Oilers, because they're good enough to hang with the Oilers first and foremost.
Well, and the reason they were in a position to have that third period devolve like it did and for the Oilers to lose their heads, again, is because they dominated the second period, right? Like, that was, the second period was almost exclusively 5-on-5. It was the only stretch of 5-on-5 we got in that game. And as you said, it was like just good, clean, physical playoff hockey that, let them control that period and build that lead to the point where the third period ended up looking like it was. And Sam Bennett was a big part of that, and his ability to skate through the neutral zone. Obviously, that one shift that leads to the breakaway goal for him, which was a huge, huge moment in the game. But it's the forecheck that creates the Sam Reinhart goal as well. There was a whole bunch of other rush chances for the Panthers in that period. It was overall just a dominant frame for them, and then it set up the next phase of things, and we'll see how it goes from here. I mean, I'm not really buying, and I want to talk to Landon about this when we have him on at one, but the whole idea that this is a turning point in the series and now Florida's under Edmonton's skin and, you know, they're off their game and are they going to be able to rebound? I'm kind of fading that as a talking point going into game four. I'm sure there's some truth to it. Like, they do have to reset, but they've got a couple days here and Edmonton's so talented. I'm not really buying the idea that that's what the series is going to look like for however much longer it goes. And Edmonton's kind of hooped. I still think there's going to be some twists and turns along the way here.
No question. And yeah, I mean, it might be a turning point, you know, like that. I think if you want to confidently assert that it was, fair enough. I mean, I'm not going to quibble necessarily with you, because I do think that there are some things here, some things in this Panthers performance that I do expect to be sticky, right? That look real to me, especially, you know, that second period thing, right? I don't know. How do the Oilers answer that? Like, how do the Oilers come up with an answer for the fact that they're just getting flattened by the Panthers in the second period, that they're not handling this Panthers stress game well enough to sort of counterattack or find their way out of the zone consistently enough when the long change sort of comes into play? I don't have an answer for that. I don't think it's an easy fix for Knobloch and the Oilers. So I think there's reasons to look at this and say the Panthers now have an upper hand. I think that's fair. But we also know how this Oilers team plays with their backs against the wall. Like, the memory of losing in the Cup final last year, that's going to stick with this team over the next 48 hours. And I'd imagine we get, if not their best effort, then pretty damn close to it in game four. And so we'll see. I think the Oilers will be impressive. The one thing I'm curious about is, you know, do the Oilers consider going 11-7, right? Do they consider getting Stetcher into the lineup? Mm-hmm. Because I do think Kulak and Klingberg are struggling in this series. I think Darnell Nurse is having some issues moving the puck. And we know that Nurse with Stetcher was something of a stabilizing force for this Oilers team against the Dallas Stars. And you know, there's a couple things that Stetcher's really good at. One of them is defending the rush. And right now, they're giving up far too many breakaway opportunities, yep. Especially. I think they've given up 7 through 3 games in this series. And look, you give up 7 breakaway opportunities against Stuart Skinner, like, that's when Stuart Skinner's problems start to become manifest, when your rush defense falls off the way that it did for Florida, did for Edmonton in games 2 and 3. They were so good defending the rush against Vegas and so good defending the rush against Dallas. And that's the part of their game that's really come apart. Stetcher played a role stabilizing it when he got into the lineup. And I'm curious to see if that's, you know, maybe something that the Oilers consider. I also wonder if they consider going Cal Pickard. And not that this has been Skinner's fault. He hasn't played well, but also the defense in front of him hasn't been good enough to justify him. Like, it hasn't been on him. They've sprung real leaks in terms of what they're surrendering to the Panthers here. But I do wonder if they go Pickard mostly, with all apologies to Pete DeBoer, as sort of a message to the team, like, hey, we got to get it together defensively here in game four, or we might be 2-time Stanley Cup final losers, which would be a heck of a painful thing to endure, I'd imagine, given sort of what that team's accomplished over the course of the last 3 or 4 years.
And losing to the same team in back-to-back years, like, that, that's a tough, tough business if that's how it does play out. The Pickard thing is interesting because it's not as if it's controversial at all. You know what I mean? It's not like pulling Ottinger and going to Casey DeSmith when Ottinger's your franchise goalie. Like, this is textbook stuff for Chris Knobloch at this point in the playoffs. Take Smith, you know what I mean? Like, take Skinner out, go to Pickard. There's no controversy, no like, oh my gosh, what is he doing? It's just like, yeah, this is something we've seen before. It's almost like part of the reset process for Edmonton at this point, not to mention for Stuart Skinner as well. Get him a day off, get him some rest, give the team the wake-up call, and then you know you can go back to him with no problem.
Totally, yeah. We put Pickard in, our team tightens up defensively, yeah. And then
just
Skinner
a thing
comes
we
back, and everyone says that Skinner's reset, but really it's that our team was reminded that they have to defend really well.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's because, let's be real, that's mostly what's happened. Or certainly that was the story against L.A., where, I mean, go watch what the Oilers were surrendering early in that series versus what they were thereafter. I mean, that night and day. I don't know that Skinner got right. I think the Oilers get right. I really do think that that's the bigger part of the story when they make that goalie swap. So, yeah, be worth considering for sure. Because, yeah, they can't afford to lose game four. And more than that, they can't afford to play that way in game four.
Mm-hmm. And Brandon Vancouver texted in, I think the key for Edmonton is getting back to their defensive game. They can defend at a really high level when they want to. And that's kind of what we're talking about as well, right? Like, for it all starts there. What are you doing in the defensive end? And just anything Knobloch can do to kind of emphasize that, snap them out of it, whatever it is, get them back to their high-end defensive game, which we've seen at times in this Stanley Cup playoff run. That's going to be so key going into game four. And then your point about potentially going 11-7, getting Troy Stetcher back in the lineup, they got to do something to figure out how to move the puck more effectively. Because I don't know if there's really been one super lengthy stretch in this series where you can say, oh, they've really figured out how to move the puck against the forecheck. Like, that, there's been ebbs and flows, and there's been times when they've been playing more in Florida's zone, but that's been more about what they've been doing to Florida's breakout than it has been them beating the forecheck effectively. Like, that's been a constant in this series, which yes, has had a lot of twists and turns. So I think, as much as we're saying, hey, do the reset, you know, get them committing to play more defensively, all that, defending against the breakaways, that's all true. But as long as Florida's winning with their forecheck so consistently like they are, like, I think it's going to be hard for Edmonton to really pull away and blow one of these games out. I think you're kind of like, it's going to look like games one and two where, hey, it's a really tight game. It's going to overtime. Maybe you get the win, but they're always going to be in it unless you can find a way to figure out that forecheck.
Yeah, and it's not about, like, it's not about, I mean, the puck management side of this, it's not about in terms of beating that Panthers forecheck. It's about using the middle of the ice. It's about being willing to take more risks, beat the first forechecker with your feet if you're an Oilers defender. And I think that's partly what's happening in the second period is you're making one mistake. They're getting on the front foot. Do not, you know, take their foot off your neck. And the only way to beat them is to take a chance, and tired hockey players put it up the wall. Tired hockey players try to make the safe play. And you just cannot survive if play or trying to repeatedly against the Florida Panthers that feeds their attack. It's effectively like one of those finger traps, right? Like, the only way out is to take a big risk, and no hunter is programmed, especially when their team's under duress to play that way. That's what's happening here. The Oilers need to be, and Oilers defenders, I think, need to be willing to take more chances in some ways to relieve that pressure. And that's hard because obviously when you're taking chances, you're also increasing the risk of it going very poorly for you.
That point about how the temptation to just go off the glass and out increases as you get tireder and you're physically and mentally tired, right? I think that's a really good one as the series goes longer. And this text just came in. I think that heavy body forecheck is getting to Edmonton's D. I thought it would take longer for their defense to wear down, but that's something to watch for, right? It's one thing to do it at the start of the series as you continue to suffer that physical toll and take those hits and give up some goals maybe with the turnovers. It becomes a little bit harder to consistently make that dangerous but high-reward play up the middle. Keep sending those texts in. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We got an open segment next, so we can dive into the inbox, continue to enjoy some Canucks offseason speculation here on the show. Before we do that, I want to tell you again about the Sportsnet 650 Jays Care 50-50, which is now live. The draw, not till July 7th, so we've got some time here. We're aiming for a $100,000 jackpot, which would be absolutely incredible. That's what we're trying to get to. We got a ways to go, so we need your help. You could win half the jackpot. The other half supports Challenger Baseball, a fantastic program that helps kids of all abilities across BC thrive through sport. Tickets start at just $10. Bundles for even more chances to win. Don't wait. Get your tickets now at jayscaregolf.rafflenexus.com or text MONEY to 650-650 now to get the link sent directly to you. And as I mentioned last week, once we get it to 15,000, we're doing these milestones, right? Once we get it to 15,000, we're going to give away a signed Quinn Hughes Vancouver Canucks jersey. So that's a big prize that's going to be up for grabs. grabs in addition to the jackpot. You can help us get there. Help us give away that Quinn Hughes jersey by buying your tickets now. Again, jayscaregolf.rafflenexus.com, or you can text money to 650-650, and we'll send you the link. Again, all in support of Challenger Baseball. It's the Sportsnet 650, Jays Care, 50-50. It's live now. The draw's on July 7th. But again, do not wait. Go get your tickets now. School's out and summer's here. Kick it off with the BC Lions summer camp game Saturday, June 21st at 4 p.m. For details and tickets, visit bclions.com. From waiting rooms to exam rooms and everything in between, Jampro keeps workplaces tidy, clean, and disinfected. For a free quote, visit jampro.ca. More Canucks talk next here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We are broadcasting live from the Kintex studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel has the expertise to get you operating faster with forklifts and pallet racking in stock. Visit them online at racksteel.com. Just a little schedule update for everyone here, including you, Drance, because I know this often comes as news to you as well. But we have the day off tomorrow, so no Wednesday show for us. We're going to try to move the crossover and Buchla.
I actually knew that one.
Oh, there you go. Wow. So this is
knew this one.
Just an update for the listeners. No Wednesday show tomorrow. We're going to try to move the crossover and Buchla to Thursday. So we'll do Wednesday on a Thursday. I don't believe we're on Friday either, so a bit of an abbreviated week for us here, but we got a show today. And as I said, send your text in 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. And Chef Graham texts in, hey guys, two quick questions. There's a lot of talk about Marco Rossi and Trevor Zegras, but do you think the Canucks might take a shot at Alexis Lafreniere? Sounds like the Rangers will be retooling their blue line. And he also says, if Canucks management ghosted the combine, do you think this means there's a trade in place involving the 15th overall pick? You would think they would go just in case they need to make the pick. That's from Chef Graham. And just to answer your first question, Graham, about will they take a shot at Lafreniere? I mean, I think they've been taking shots at Lafreniere for a while now, right? We know the connection between Emily Castonguay and Lafreniere. She was his agent before she joined the Canucks front office. We've heard multiple reports over the years that they really like the player, but we've also always heard that the Rangers are not interested in giving up on him. And I know there's some idea that, you know, he took the big step backwards last year. The Rangers seem very motivated to retool that roster, to make changes. Doesn't seem like there's a lot of untouchables, so you never know. But I also kind of look at it and think, if there had been a fit between the two teams on that player, it probably would have happened already. Things can change. Evaluation can change, but that's kind of the way I would look at that player specifically.
Yeah, I mean, they literally acquired Vancouver's star centerman and didn't include Lafreniere.
Yeah.
A few months ago.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of speaks volumes, right? Like, yeah. Doesn't that tell us,
like, if they wanted to do it, that's probably the deal where it would have happened.
That's a pretty good opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You think it came up?
I'm guessing they talked about it. I'm guessing they had some conversations.
So, I mean, I know Alexis Lafreniere has had some inconsistency, but, you know, clearly they know the guy that they're dealing with. Right, it's clear that he's not really been on the market as much as we've discussed him,
mm-hmm.
or Vancouver fans have discussed him, or his name's sort of been bandied about. Now, could that change if we're talking about them adding like a superstar level player? Maybe, but why would the Rangers, given the age of their roster and their dearth of sort of like what they're going to make a futures trade?
Yeah. Not for that player.
They're going to acquire Elias Pettersson?
Yeah.
Are they going to acquire Elias Pettersson? Because that's the other, like, the one that would make sense to make it a discussion is like, well, maybe if Elias Pettersson, JT Miller's team is going to go out and acquire Elias Pettersson. They want to bring the show to Manhattan.
Can you imagine?
They really want to play on Broadway. It's gonna be a script written by Arthur Miller. Like, come on,
like,
let's get serious. We gotta
grab some headlines here. You know, we gotta get priority back or prominence back in the local market. Let's add some drama to this. Let's do it. That would be absolutely incredible if they were to do that. Now, to the second question about Canucks management, or at least senior management, because I understand there were representatives there at the combine, not being at the scouting combine in Buffalo, and whether that means there's some sort of handshake agreement on a deal for that 15th overall pick already. And other people have texted in about this as well. I think Reg texted in, just wondering what you guys heard about this thing I've been reading about, that the Canucks are sitting on some sort of trade until the AHL playoffs are done. I've definitely seen this crop up, right? That, hey, for various reasons, whether it's waiting until the Stanley Cup finals are over, because that's what the league likes to do, whether it's because you've still got trade chips playing in the Calder Cup playoffs for Abbotsford, or whatever the case is, that, you know, and I think part of this comes back to also, like, Jim Rutherford has been very clear that they're probably not going to be major players, at least at the high end of the free agency market. And there's almost this sense of certainty about it. And like, hey, we might have a lot of our business done by then. And I always think back to the trade deadline where they acquired Elias Lindholm, and Jim Rutherford was on radio in Toronto like a few hours before that. And he was like, well, we might not have to wait until the trade deadline to make some moves. And then it breaks a few hours, right? So it wouldn't be totally out of character for Jim Rutherford to kind of leave some breadcrumbs for us to follow there. And you start to get questions like this. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they, I don't think there's like a handshake deal in the drawer. We'll announce it as soon as Abbotsford's eliminated or the Stanley Cup is over. But I wouldn't be surprised at all if they have like three or four irons in the fire and they feel pretty good about at least one of them coming through for the 15th overall pick. That just thinking about like what logistically makes sense, that's kind of where I would land, more so than, oh yeah, the deal for Marco Rossi is done. We just got to wait for them to announce it.
Yes. I think the fact that the Canucks front office and the Wild front office is so tightly knit, right? That like Bill Guerin and Patrick Alvin, like, it's not just that Bill Guerin is an ex-Rutherford lieutenant, right? Like, Bill Guerin and Patrick Alvin have like traveled Europe together scouting. Like, they're like friends.
Yeah.
You know, there's you know, among that crew of like Pittsburgh boys, right? There's kids who've gotten married. Like, you know, one guy's kids and one other guy's kids, right? Like, it's a very tight-knit crew. So that does sort of, I guess, just as I evaluate the information, right, and evaluate the theory that you're positing here, I suppose I would at least sort of add a
So that maybe, like,
I would add an extra
If there's...
Because of that dynamic.
If there's a deal done, it would be the Marco Rossi Minnesota deal. You know what I mean?
Like, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Like, that's that. There's an extra element beyond just the generalities that I'm laying out that make that at least more plausible.
So at least something I'm more interested in entertaining.
Yeah.
Explicitly. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
And again, like, I just think it's I'm sure. I mean, they've had a lot of time off now. I'm sure they've gone down the road with lots of different teams about packages built around the 15th overall, right? And again, whether it's, oh, we're going to do it for Marco Rossi, or we feel very confident that there will be at least a deal out there for us, I understand it. It is kind of funny, like, to just the optics of it, because we've all been talking about it so much that we expect them to trade the 15th overall pick, and then for Jim Rutherford and Alvin not to be at the combine, it's like, wow, they are really, really set on trading that 15th overall pick. We'll see what it all, you know, if that ultimately pans out and which player it's for. By the way, I don't know if you remember, but when we had Bukla on, I don't know, maybe a month ago, 6 weeks ago, and this was before I think we had really settled on they're definitely trading that 15th overall pick, and I hypothesized that the player that they were going to draft at 15 was going to be Victor Eklund, because the small, slightly smaller Swedish winger who's initially projected like 7th or 8th overall slowly starts to fall as the draft process goes on. And then he'll end up being there at 15, and then Canucks will take him as best player available, which is basically what happened with Lekkomäki. That process is in full swing, by the way. Like, I'm actually, the number one reason I'm disappointed that they're going to trade the 15th overall pick is that I won't get to take a victory lap on that take. Because if they keep that pick, that's 100% what is happening. Like, 100% what is happening. I think Scott Wheeler at The Athletic had Eklund mocked like 13th. And I was like, oh man, just a couple more spots, and he's going to be there.
You can taste it now.
I can taste it. It's 100% happening.
Yeah. Happy for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I just... We'll all be shocked, I think, if the Canucks stick at 15. I think internally they'll be stunned if they end up on the clock at 15. I think the draft table, they'll be like, huh?
How did this happen? I guess we'll just go pick Eklund.
What?
I guess.
Yeah. So.
All right, I think Drance's Wi-Fi might have conked out on us. Oh, we got you back.
Yeah, sorry all about right. that.
Maybe it was just a really long blink.
No, you know how like sometimes your computer can go back if you like swipe your keyboard slightly incorrectly?
Right.
And sort of got a swipe wrong. I swiped wrong. I did not swipe right. Anyway, the the overall I think the Canucks will be surprised if they keep 15. I think you're right. Eklund feels like the profile of guy that might fall. And I think there's an interesting conversation to be had too, where you know, if we're talking about a league in which skill, you know, may potentially come to be sort of like undervalued, like are we mm-hmm. entering a moment where the lesson drawn from Edmonton's success, driven as it is by McDavid and Draisaitl, and Florida's success, driven as it is by having 8 top line caliber forwards in their forward group, if people are like, well, we really need size and toughness in our lineup. Right. And I think that would be absolutely the wrong lesson. The Canucks are obviously on the other side of that poll, given sort of Pettersson, Garland, Hughes as kind of their 3 best skaters. But, you know, and so it's unfortunate because the Canucks aren't necessarily positioned to like lean into going against the pendulum
mm-hmm.
on this, you know, like they're not necessarily well positioned to just be like, you know, we'll move in the other direction. If everyone's zigging, we'll zag. Like, they're not well positioned to do that, which is a little bit frustrating, I suppose. But, you know, I do think at the draft table anyway, where really you're just trying to get the most skilled possible guy, you know, the idea of drafting for need is always ridiculous and looks even more ridiculous if you talk about it 12 months on, 18 months on, which is really the lesson of the, like, we need to add defensemen. Let's pick Tom Volander. Thing, right? Where it's just like, man, now this team's thirsty for forwards and we're less than 2 years down the road. You know, so but I think there is going to be opportunity. If you're willing to zag, if you're willing to prioritize and value skill above all else, I think there's going to be opportunities for teams at the draft table to get good value out of players in that manner.
At the draft table and on the trade market. And probably in the free agency market as well, right? You know what I mean? Like, not bargains necessarily in free agency, but guys undervalued based on the rest of the market. And again, like, that's one of the interesting things about Marco Rossi, I think, is that from what we're hearing, as much as Bill Guerin's out there saying, hey, I want to make a fair deal, I'm not giving this player away, you know, I don't have to trade him. Like, it doesn't sound like the asking price is going to be exorbitant here. It doesn't sound like this is, you know, oh man, it's going to be too rich for the Canucks to be in on the Marco Rossi sweepstakes. And I think a big part of that is Minnesota's internal evaluation of the player, which is we don't think we can win with him in the playoffs, which is probably shared by a lot of teams around the league. And hey, they might be right. Bill Guerin might be right that, you know what, I don't think Marco Rossi can be a winning top 6 center on a playoff team. But that, like, you're able to bet against that valuation, right? You're able to bet against that opinion of the player and take a swing on the upside. And I think for the Canucks, because you're right, like, they've already got this group of players in place that so desperately needs that edge added. Pettersson, Hughes, Garland, etc. Like, you really do need it. But you also got to plan for the future a little bit, right? Like, we don't know how long Quinn Hughes is going to be here. We don't know how long Connor Garland, who has 1 year left on his deal, is going to be here. Who knows what the future holds for Elias Pettersson? So, yeah, you need it for this year, but you also got to lay the groundwork for what the next, you know, 5 or 6 years look like as well. And I would much rather have a core of 2 or 3 or 4 really skilled players and then try to add the edge on top of that, the edge around them, than vice versa. Like, that is so much more appealing to me than, hey, we went out and we acquired, you know, a guy who's going to top out at 30 points, but he's super physical and super hard to play against. And now we'll go get our first line center. That sounds much less fun to me than, hey, we've got the skill and now we're going to add the grit around it. I just think you got to choose one path probably. And that one makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're dead on. And so, yeah, I mean, look, this offseason is going to be fascinating, and we're seeing it in real time. And by the way, so are 30 other teams, right? The fact that the Oilers and the Panthers have arrived here and are kind of the only teams in one another's weight class. You know, I mean, look, it was a running bit that we did for what? Ever since our inception, the idea that anything can't happen. Not hearing that debated much anymore, are we? I mean, I'm not trying to be a jerk here. Like, honestly, it's a conversation that's shifted. No one is saying that with a straight face in a world where this Stanley Cup is being contested by the same two teams 2 years in a row, where only two teams have made it out of the Eastern Conference dating back 6 years, where every year we kind of know in the Western Conference final, it's going to be one of Dallas, Vegas, Edmonton, or Colorado. And it's like no one else really makes it to that level. And if they do, they're quickly dispatched in four or five. And, you know, I mean, there has not been a lot of drama or parity in the NHL playoffs in years. Carolina is going to make it to the conference final most of the time. Maybe the New York Rangers sneak in every now and then. Like that's how this is working at the moment. And, you know, I do think that that has really significant implications for how teams should consider, especially teams in the Canucks spot, where you're kind of throwing a Hail Mary and where the standard that they're most likely to be judged on is can they make the playoffs? You know, yeah, of course. Of course. Look, if you have Quinn Hughes, you are always going to have a chance to make the playoffs every year out, provided he's healthy and remains at this level, you're going to have a chance to make the playoffs almost irregardless of what you do elsewhere on the roster. The path though, to getting to where Florida is, to getting where Edmonton is, even if those teams get a little bit worse this season, you know, the challenge of outcompeting St. Louis and Utah and LA and those teams with more flexibility and more asset power. I mean, that becomes kind of the bar. And even there, we're talking about, you know, like in Game of Thrones, they're talking about the petty squabbles of nobles while an army of zombies amasses on the northern frontier. It's like, what's the bigger thing we should focus on, right? Like, this is it. The playoff question is kind of besides the point. I feel like this has been a showcase in that, you know, with really severe implications for the Canucks. Like, big picture, Jamie, we've been talking about the Canucks offseason, speculating about the path forward, on and on. Like, just taking a step back and talking about our underlying assumption here. Is this team's best route to winning a Stanley Cup really through convincing Quinn Hughes to stay long term?
It's a very fair question. Like, I think
'Cause isn't that where we should start?
I think probably it is, because he's just that good. You get that,
Okay.
you get ink on paper, and then you figure the rest out. Like, I think that is totally viable. And again, it depends on the time frame we're talking about, right? Like, if we want to say over the next, what, 8 years, chances, what maximizes your chances of winning a Stanley Cup? Is it going all out to try to convince Quinn Hughes to stay, or is it some other strategy? The missing, what's the word when you don't know something in a math equation? What is it? Variable. The
The missing variable?
variable that we're dealing with here,
Solve
though.
for? What are you solving for?
Yeah, the variable we're dealing with here is what are the chances it works? You know what I mean? Like, if it's because
Right.
if you go all out and it's a 1% chance that it works, that's a very different risk equation than if you're like, hey, we've got a really good shot here. We just need to do these things to improve our team. You know what I mean? Like, it's not so much that is it better to keep Quinn Hughes? Of course it is. He's Quinn Hughes. He's absolutely phenomenal. Arguably the most talented player of his franchise has ever had. One of the best skaters in the league. To me, the question is, how many resources should you be willing to commit to that goal, given the uncertainty about how likely it is to be successful? And no one knows that. No one can answer that. Like, the front office can't answer that with 100% certainty. The only person who knows that for sure, and he might not even know at this stage, is Quinn Hughes.
Yeah, you're not wrong. And, you know, I mean, the only guy who knows it is Quinn Hughes, but we're also seeing with the actions of people who might know, right? I mean, that's sort of the Rick Tocchet. That's why the Rick Tocchet departure, I think, looms so large in the imagination of Canucks fans, is this idea of like someone with inside knowledge selling their stock.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's the scary part of this. And so if that's true and you're not going to go all in on an uncertain variable here, right, then do you need to go about spending this offseason building a hedge position?
Mm-hmm.
Do you need to be careful that what you're committing to doesn't necessarily put you in a bind where what comes next in terms of your road back to being a credible playoff team or better takes 4 years longer because of the decisions made this summer? Or can you not afford to think that way?
Right? And that's I agree. But like, that's where like Marco Rossi becomes really interesting. It's like, well, you're going to be happy. I think you're going to be happy to have Marco Rossi, even if Quinn Hughes leaves, you know what I mean? Given his age, and there's something at least you can work around there. I'm not saying as a foundational player or anything like that, but at least as a useful piece versus going out and acquiring, you know, like Matt Duchene, as we've talked about, or something at his age, then all of a sudden it's like, if Quinn Hughes leaves anyway, you're going to be like, why the heck do we have Matt Duchene on the roster? You know what I mean? It's going to be like, why did we do that? Versus if you acquire the younger player, I think at least there's still some utility to having them around. By the way, before we go to break here, I think the other fascinating thing about this point of Edmonton and Florida really separating themselves at the top of the league is the pool of teams that are like, man, we really need to do something, is so much bigger and includes really good teams in a way it doesn't always. Like Dallas, they get to the conference finals every year and they're like, man, we might have to trade Jason Robertson to shake our roster up. You know what I mean? Because they can't get over the Edmonton hump. You look at like Carolina, I'm sure is going to be very motivated to do something. Vegas is always motivated. Colorado can't be satisfied with their track record in the playoffs since winning the Stanley Cup. You go through it and that next tier of teams that's not quite, there's a pretty big gap, actually, I think you could argue, between them and Florida and Edmonton. It's not just the like teams that are like, we're a fringe playoff team, we want to take that leap, we're really going to be aggressive. It's like the whole league is at this point motivated to be extremely aggressive. And I think that's in large part due to the gap in quality between Edmonton and Florida and everyone else.
Yeah, the gap in quality, right. The massive sort of gulf that these teams have to close. There's another thing too that I just want to bring up as a question that we can like get into we can spend a full segment on this, mm-hmm. but you know, is there really a path for the Canucks to the level that Florida or Edmonton is? Like, does it require more, right? That does it require you to lock up Quinn Hughes, but not necessarily like a 3-year deal doesn't even do it, or a 2-year deal doesn't even do it. It's like this team might be so far away from that level, from really that level, right? Like that level we're mm-hmm. talking about, that level that they really never got close to, if you're being honest with yourself, in 2023-24, that it's like you almost need the long-term deal so that you can like have a season where it goes badly and get lucky to land the other elite talent. You know, I mean, we're talking about miles here. And so I think there's huge implications for this. I don't begrudge the team for trying to charge headlong into let's get back on track. Let's keep our core together. Let's charge through this wall here. But I do think the bet is getting thinner and thinner as we go, right? I always thought it was thin. I looked wrong for a bit. I don't think I was. And now it just feels like even if you win, there's still going to be a need for something of a like deep breath and a future focused rethink, even if you're able to sort of emerge on the other side of this quagmire with Quinn Hughes locked up long term.
That's a fascinating idea, and I think we should get into it at some point. Up next, we're going to chat with Landon Ferraro. We'll talk Edmonton Oilers, Florida Panthers in the Stanley Cup final, and Abby Canucks going to the Calder Cup final as well next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance here. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, footwear and orthotics working together with you in step 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Landon Ferraro is going to join us momentarily here on the show. Get his thoughts on the Edmonton Oilers down 2-1 in the Stanley Cup final. And also the Abbotsford Canucks going to the Calder Cup Finals, which start on Friday in Charlotte, and we'll talk to Tristan Nielsen as well. We'll talk to Tristan Nielsen, Abby Canucks forward, at 1:30, get his thoughts on the team going off to the Calder Cup final. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And, you know, we were having the conversation about the path for the Canucks getting into this stratosphere, right, and just the path for NHL teams in general getting into the stratosphere, because Edmonton and Florida look a cut above right now. Now joining us here on the show, former NHL player and now a contributor here on Sportsnet 650 and on Sportsnet TV, he is Landon Ferraro. Landon, what's going on, man?
Oh, not too much. Just trying to get organized and ready for the start of the Calder Cup.
Yeah. Yeah, busy time for you too, huh? I mean, because I know you do some work covering the Oilers, and now with Abby going to the Calder Cup Finals, it's fun to have this much going on still relevant to Canucks fans at this time of the season.
For sure it is, and the way that Abby's gone through this playoff run, and you know, and the game the other night was unbelievable, right? They're down 2-0, and just like they have in multiple points of the run, like they make a great push and completely take over the third period. Like, those guys are gaining so much experience right now, and to be around them, seeing how pumped up the whole organization was, like, it's, you know, it's a great thing for the whole franchise.
Yeah, and I know you were there on site calling the game on with Brandon Astle for game 6, the win for the Abbotsford Canucks. What was it like just being in that building, seeing the crowd support, seeing the atmosphere, and as you said, that comeback win in a big moment?
It was awesome. I mean, like, we all know that playoff hockey is the best hockey, and it doesn't matter if it's the NHL level or the American League level, like the intensity, the, you know, you coming into the rink, all the fans are in there for warm up. Like, you could feel the energy in the building and how much fun it was to call the game, especially as they started to make their push in the third period. And you could really see that, you know, like, it was there for them, and you could sense the guys knew that. And, you know, when they put their head down and got to work, like, it was exactly what you want to see from your team in a situation to close out a series.
Landon, we were talking about how, you know, most of the teams that make it to the Calder Cup final, like, most teams that make it to this level, there's sort of some obvious young breakout stars that up their game, and that when we look back at the roster a few years on, we understand in part how they drove the team's success. But there's often, you know, sort of like a 24 or 25 year old breakout type guy who plays well in the playoffs, and it turns out to matter. Like, it turns out that they're a lot better than anyone imagined they might be. I kind of suggested on the program yesterday that it's difficult to parse necessarily in real time which guy is sort of most responsible for it. But I'm going to throw the impossible question to you. Like, which of the sort of Canucks organizational depth pieces has most turned your head or maybe changed your mind over the course of this run?
The change your mind's a hard one, because I don't think I was sitting there too down on too many guys, just seeing how well they've played as a group down there. But I mean, it's at different points, and I think that's the best part of this run for Abbotsford is, of course, Linus Karlsson's leading the team in goals and points. I think he was sitting third in the league in scoring as well, and he's had a great postseason. But like, everyone has jumped up and done their part at different points. You know, Baines had an unbelievable game 6. He was leading the team in assists, but he couldn't find the back of the net for the longest time, and then he shows up and gets 3 in the last 2 games to close out the series. And he was, even without the 2 goals in game 6, he was one of the best players on the ice. His ability to have poise in really chaotic situations and be able to make a 6-7 foot little saucer pass, just, he's got the softest hands and he's able to find those plays. And, you know, he had set up a couple others. He had one with, he fed Ty Mueller for a little bit of a breakaway chance. You know, he just created all around. So, I mean, you know, he stepped up big, but, you know, Max Sass and using his speed and really, like, the second effort is what I appreciate about him the most. You know, he, he carries the puck through the neutral zone extremely well and can make plays. But when something doesn't go right, it's like he finds another gear to get back on the back check and cause a turnover quickly. Like the amount that, you know, they'd lose possession in the offensive zone and the way that he would, you know, react and get back, like he was causing a turnover before it even exited the offensive zones. So they're able to keep play in. So, I mean, those two, especially late in this series were really, really good.
Yeah. And so you were on that Grand Rapids team that won the Calder Cup, right? I'm not wrong about that. Just want to fact check myself before I go on.
2013. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, we kind of knew, like, even in real time, what Riley Sheehan and Thomas Tatar and Gustav Nyquist could be, right? But the guy that I'm sort of thinking about is like the breakout would be like Glenn Denning, like Luke Glendening, who starts that season in the ECHL, right? After you guys win the Calder, he spends 18 more games in the American League in his career and you know, has a chance to get to 850 games if he gets another NHL deal here, has sort of been around the league and made an impact for a decade. Is there anyone off radar that stands out to you as sort of, you know, you had a front row seat to what Glendening did with 16 points in that playoff run. Is there anyone that stands out to you as sort of like matching that profile on this Abbotsford team?
Well, I mean, I'll flip it to the defense side. So it's a little different, but at the same time, like Kirill Kudryavtsev has been very good down there. His poise with the puck, his ability to break up plays with his stick. He's not an overly punishing hitter, but at the same time, he takes the body extremely well. You know, he showed poise on a couple different occasions at the top of the blue line, walking the line, not just throwing it away, being able to read when it's okay to pinch down, when to come back out. But where I find him extremely good is in the defensive zone, going back for a puck. Like it takes a lot of skill and hockey IQ to get that forechecker on your hip, but still be able to see where your next guy is and absorb that hit, make the play, and then join the rush as well. I was a big fan of him in preseason, seeing him for the first time, and he showed really well in the exhibition games that he got into. But like, this is a guy that has really kind of stapled himself into the lineup and found a way to really be a positive impact. I think he's, you know, as a guy, especially sitting behind, you know, a Mancini and Willanen and, you know, Akito Rossi had good game. Jet Wu, especially as of just saying that, he had an unbelievable game six. But Kudryavtsev has been a really positive piece for me. And I think that, you know, he could have a really big future ahead of him.
Yeah, we were talking about Kirill Kudryavtsev on the show yesterday because, as you said, look, there's so much that he does that stands out, and the results with him on the ice have been really, really impressive. What's going to be the key for him to make sure that he can find a way to carve out a role and stick at the NHL level, given his size, the fact that he's a left shot guy and not really a power play specialist?
Yeah, I think for him, it's, you know, his work ethic is solid, and you know that's always going to be his base. But I think as he gets his skating a little bit, a little bit stronger, and that'll come with some age and some strength as well. But I just said how good of a job he does going back to get pucks and making that play to pop it to the forward. But for him, adding that next piece of jumping up into the rush a little bit more, trusting himself. And it's different. It's hard, right? Like you're in your first year, you're trying to make sure you're doing everything on the defensive side perfectly, because that's, of course, the number one thing for him. But, adding that next part, do I think he's going to have a crazy jump in offense? I don't know about that, but he's also sitting at 7 points in 15 games in the playoffs and being able to contribute. But, with adding that speed or power into his skating, he might be able to push by that first guy, and now he's taking two steps and can move the puck. It doesn't have to be accepting a hit, and now you're kind of out of the play as well. So, I mean, his skating will only open up, his hockey IQ even more. Like, there's points where you could tell he read the play perfectly, but he wasn't sure if he'd be able to get there or not. With with a bit more confidence and a bit more of the power skating side, like he'll be able to hold more pucks in the offensive zone. He'll be able, especially on PKs and in defensive zone situations, be able to take two strides out and cut off a pass that you might not be able to right now. Just those little pieces that can separate you, right?
Yeah, and I find it fascinating also for just the Abbotsford team as a whole. It's such a long season, and you know, I was saying the other day, like it's kind of funny always when I remember that the Calder Cup goes longer than the Stanley Cup. It doesn't start till Friday. Now you add cross-continent travel in as well, which is different for the AHL players, right? Going to Charlotte, like. Just what do you remember from your experience that really stands out, just kind of about that physical and mental fatigue and toll that can set in at this time of year?
Well, and I'll start off by saying, like, you know, it's different now as well. Like there's, you know, we didn't have a play-in round when I was going through the American League playoffs. So, you know, like Charlotte's done a good job of closing out series well, but they didn't have a best of three to get to at the beginning. So, you know, they've only played 12 games. Abbotsford's already played 18, right? Like, that's a really big difference. But at the same time, you know, it is very similar from the year that I won the Calder Cup with Grand Rapids to this Abbotsford team. You know, we played all but two games through that whole run, and Syracuse was sitting on the other side. They didn't lose a game until game one of the finals when we beat them. And they'd been sitting there for about a week waiting for the finals to start. Well, Charlotte's in the same situation. They've dropped some games coming through the run, but at the same time, they've been sitting there for a week. They've had a lot of success through the playoffs so far. And that can be something where, you know, Abbotsford, yeah, they've played more games, but they're also, like, they're still in it. They haven't had a chance to take that breath and sit back and maybe start feeling some of, you know, some of the, you know, I don't want to say pain, but some of the soreness and some of the bumps and bruises that you get going through. Abbotsford's just riding that momentum and, you know, kind of going about it that way. You know, I think it's big for them in Abbotsford in game one to have a really good start and show Charlotte that, you know, like we're game ready right now. We're not feeling this series out. We're not feeling the game out. And that's exactly what we did to Syracuse. You could tell kind of how stunned they were in game one that not only were they in a tight game, but they weren't the fastest team from the get-go. They weren't, you know, winning every battle. Like things just didn't fall into their lap. They had to find a way to start to grind and it took them, you know, three games to figure it out. So we were able to jump on them that way. I think Abbotsford's going to be able to be in the same situation where, you know, they can jump on Charlotte early and try and take advantage of that.
What did you make of last night's game, all the extracurriculars, and the idea being floated popularly today that, you know, the Oilers lost their composure and may be in real trouble now, down 2-1 with game four on Florida ice?
You know, I mean, I said it last night on the post game that I was doing for the station in Edmonton, and you know, like the Oilers lost the plot last night, and you know, I was so impressed by them in game one because, you know, not only did they play really well, but they took the game physically to Florida, and you could tell they weren't ready for that. But the best part of it was it didn't look like Edmonton was trying to force that physical style into their game just to try and show that they were as tough as Florida. They played their game perfectly, and because of that, the intensity was there. They were on top of every puck. Every time there was a turnover, they were right there to finish a body again. Like it looked like a real, you know, real machine-like team going through a game. And you flip to last night, and it, you know, it was a tough start. They, you know, but at the same time, they have three power plays in the first, and they weren't able to figure out a way to get one in. And you know, they have that, you know, good start, and Perry gets his goal to start the second period and get it to 2-1. But you know, a minute and a half later, it's 3-1. And from that moment on, it was like they were going to show that they weren't scared of them. They weren't afraid to get into the mix, but it turned into just trying to win, you know, after the whistle to the next drop of the puck and not worried about what was going on between the whistles as much. You know, the thing I will say for the Oilers is, you know, they've done a great job at responding through this season with all that they've had to deal with, and through the playoffs here until this game. Like, that was the first game they lost back-to-back since game one and two of the first round against L.A. You know, they've done a really good job of responding. You know, the extra day of rest, I think, will help them to, you know, just kind of refocus and throw that game out. There's nothing to look at. Like, they'll be able to, the best part, I would say, as you're talking through it, is not one person in the Oilers dressing room could sit there after the game last night and say, you know what, like, I had a pretty good game here. The other guy's got to figure it out. Like, team-wide, no one had their game. Everyone seemed more concerned with all the extracurriculars. So if they can, you know, use the veteran leadership in that group, because, you know, for the most part, that's a very veteran group that have been in, you know, either the situation last year and getting that experience, or in other places have done it. So, you know, they'll be able to kind of sit back, understand that if we play our game, don't worry about them nearly as much. Like, we're right in this series. We took ourselves out and we gave Florida too much easy offense. We gave them way too many power plays even before the game got out of hand and it just turned into a bit of a mess. Like, they gave Florida way too much easy room on the ice. They just look disjointed, and that's where, as a player, when you're sitting on those, it's almost the best thing that can happen in a loss. Like, if it would have been another overtime loss, you're sitting there and you feel a bit more defeated. But when it's that wide open, you're like, it's just easier to say, like, guys, we were just not any good. We didn't play to our strengths. We didn't do all the things that have got us to this point. So they just need to reset and come back in game four and try and have a good start. Don't worry about winning the game. Worry about winning the first 5 minutes and then just start breaking it down from there.
One story that's really emerged is these second periods in which the Panthers are basically running a rough shot over the Oilers, skating them off the ice. I mean, they've outshot them 2-1, outscored them 5-2. Every game is turned with the Panthers' dominance in the middle frame. What's an answer for it? Why are the Panthers such animal at, and you know, with an emphasis like italics on the word animals? They are animals in the second period. What? Why does their game play so well?
Well, I think a lot of it goes to how the Oilers are wanting to play in the second period. Like, you're clearly, as that game was going on, and even through the first few games, like, the Oilers can't carry the puck through the neutral zone every single time and try and enter with possession. You know, the Panthers are doing an extremely good job of holding their defensive blue line and causing turnovers, whether just before the blue or just inside of it. And then you have the long change. So it's harder to get off. It's harder to make your line change quick and clean, especially when you don't end up getting the puck in deep. You know, I think it's going to be really important for them to, you know, accept that we're going to have to dump some pucks in. We're going to have to go on a forecheck and retrieve and be willing to take an extra hit here and there. Because, you know, like last night, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, when's the last time you've seen that many Oilers get hit in the open ice trying to enter a zone, right? Like, they just refuse to chip it by. And I think having to make Florida turn, get them moving, let them essentially, like, give them a chance to make a mistake under pressure. Because the way, especially in the second period, like, it didn't feel like any play they had to make was that tough, because it's a turnover. It doesn't even have to be a tape-to-tape pass. It can be a bank off the boards, and your guys are already flying up there. And you have, especially with the way the Oilers play, they always have that defenseman joining the rush. So now you end up turning a puck over, like, that's where all your odd man rushes start coming from, and it's a lot to ask. So I think managing the puck a little bit better, being willing to accept the fact that you're going to have to dump some pucks and play a bit of a harder style, not just, you know, I don't want to say just hope, but, you know, just think that your skill is going to be able to walk through, you know, three defensive Panthers standing just inside their blue line, waiting for the guy to just try and take them on one-on-one. right? Like, they're going to have to be okay getting a little uncomfortable and playing that style of hockey.
The other question going into game four, I think, is who gets the start in net for Edmonton? Skinner pulled. Now, I know Knobloch said today, look, I'm not putting too much of that on him of what happened in game three on Stuart Skinner, but also left it open that it could be either goalie. What would you do in Knobloch's shoes going into game four in the crease?
I mean, that is a really tough one because, again, it's not like the Oilers had a great start to the game and Skinner gave up three goals and they were out of it right away on soft stuff. You know, I still don't think he had a great game or, you know, even really that good of a game himself. You know, I'm a Pickard fan. I like how he battles in the net. He did a great job of carrying him through the run when he took the net from Skinner early in the LA series. But, you know, at the same time, you have a guy in Skinner that the guys clearly like. You know, he's played well. His numbers have been slowly dwindling a little bit. You know, that's where when you have such a close 1A, 1B situation, it does make it harder at times because, you know, for most teams, it's easy. Like, you're going back to your starter. Like, that is your guy. You're going to ride or die with him. But in this instance, you know, Pickard's shown enough that, you know, he can play. He's shown that he can win series and that he battles extremely hard in the net. You know, I would like to see him get the start because regardless of what happens in the net, the guys in front of him need to be, you know, not just a little bit better, but quite a bit better. And if that happens and you have Pickard in net that's battling his butt off like he always does, like, that just gives the guys such a good feeling knowing that no matter what happens in there, like, he is going to give you everything he possibly has. And I think that's why I feel a little more comfortable flipping back to Pickard for game four.
Landon, great stuff as always. We appreciate it. We'll chat again soon.
All right, have a good one, guys.
That is Landon Ferraro, former NHL player, joining us here on Canucks Talk. Guests on Sportsnet 650, call in on the hotline, powered by Power West Industries. Don't get caught in the dark when it matters most. Visit them at powerwest.ca today. They keep the lights on. JanPro, from waiting rooms to exam rooms and everything in between, JanPro keeps workplaces tidy, clean, and disinfected. For a free quote, visit JanPro.ca. We'll talk Abbey Canucks with one of their forwards, Tristan Nielsen. And joins us next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Trantz. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors. For over 50 years, visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. And now joining us on the hotline, powered by Power West Industries, from the Abbotsford Canucks, he is forward Tristan Nielsen. Tristan, thanks for doing this today. How are you?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. And first of all, I mean, congratulations on wrapping up the Western Conference Championship in the AHL. How's it feel? How's it feel to be going to the Calder Cup Finals?
It's exciting. It's definitely a special opportunity, and I'm just happy I get to do it with the guys on the team.
Where does that moment, game six in Abbotsford in front of the hometown crowds, you know, coming back from down 2-0 in the game, where does that rank for you in kind of the positive memories, the great memories of your hockey career?
I just think it made it a more exciting way to do it. I think kind of the back half of the whole season and playoffs, whether we're down 2 goals or up 2 goals or even 3 goals, I feel like we've always had that confidence from within ourselves that the job can still get done.
Tristan, has there been a moment on this run, whether it's, you know, the do or die game in the Denver suburbs or what have you, just a moment on this run where it felt like this team gathered that sort of momentum that you need at this time of year?
I feel like there's been multiple situations, whether it's been the overtime goals or the big hits, but I feel like it's really come from within our group. We're really hard on each other and we hold each other accountable. And I think just like a lot of locker room talk and having meetings about calling guys out and also having the coaches be there as well. I think it's been just a great learning curve, but also it's just really come from within.
And sort of seeing everyone kind of hit, level up, play this well as a group. I mean, how much fun are you guys having as a group, and how much does that matter when you get into those pressure situations in terms of being able to handle them as consistently as your club's been able to?
I think it's huge. I mean, it's like anything. When you're having fun, you're probably going to be more excited about it. You're going to be more excited about showing up to the rink. You're going to be just overall a happier person. I think just from our standpoint, or even mine, I think when we're playing our best, we're very positive, and we have really good energy on the bench. And I think it all kind of starts from, whether it's away from the rink or whatever, you're hanging out with the guys and you're having fun and you're enjoying kind of life.
You've been with Abbotsford since it started, right? You got in on the ground floor since the franchise moved from Utica, and the AHL affiliate for the Canucks relocated to Abbotsford. And, you know, we always talk about building a culture in hockey, and I'm guessing that's harder to do at the AHL level because there is so much flux and guys are getting called up, and certainly that was the case this year. But, you know, there is also a small group of players who have been there for a while. It's Chase Waters, yourself, Danila Klimovich has played games there, you know, Jet Wu. How have you seen the culture develop and grow in Abbotsford over your time there?
I mean, it's been kind of a pleasure to be a part of. We kind of hold our vets, I'd say, hold a lot of accountability with being very open to young guys or new guys, and kind of, I guess, forcing them to join kind of our motto. It's kind of funny to say, but we kind of have like, I just feel like, I don't even know how to describe it, but we just kind of make it very welcoming and make it easy for everyone to join in. So whether it was a new guy picked up in the off season or a trade or whatever, I always feel like when guys come here, they always say that we have a really good like core group in Abbotsford. And I think that that goes a long way. I mean, it's like anything, when you're having fun or you're excited to go to the rink or you're excited to go to work, it just makes for a more joyful experience and makes for the hard work being a lot easier.
And Tristan, you know, you're from BC, from Fort St. John, and you started your WHL career in Calgary, then got traded to the Giants. You had that great playoff run with the Giants where you guys went to the WHL finals, and then you graduate from the WHL and you've played your first 4 years of pro hockey in Abbotsford. Now you're on this great run with Abbotsford. I mean, have you had a chance just kind of to reflect on the opportunity you've had to play so much hockey in your home province, not just play so much hockey, but go on these runs with these teams in your home province?
Yeah, no, I'm very grateful. I feel like, obviously being from up north, I feel like the lower mainland with all the hockey I've played down here has kind of become my new home. I have so much respect for all the fans down here and how supportive they are and how great they are. And it's also just been nice. I mean, the amount of friends, the amount of memories I've made down here on both teams and in both organizations, it's been incredible. I'm very, very fortunate. I know a lot of guys always say they wish they played at home, and I know a lot of teams don't have, or I guess there's not a lot of teams out there and where everyone's from, but I'm very grateful and I'm very fortunate.
With
hello,
Tristan, the sort of first game of the final coming up soon here, what's this week been like for you and your teammates? How do you prepare, and is it important to sort of keep it routine, even though these are going to be the highest stakes games for many of you that you've ever played professionally?
Yeah, I think obviously you're doing your video and you're doing your research kind of things, but I think the big thing for us is when we play our way and we play our game, it's pretty hard to compete with. I mean, we've shown that series after series when we're playing the right way and we're playing, I guess, the Abbotsford Canucks way, it's hard to defend and it's hard to stop. So for us, it's just about, you know, recovery and getting ready mentally, but our preparation will kind of be the same.
Tristan, really appreciate the time. Congratulations again on getting to this point, and best of luck in the Calder Cup Finals.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Our pleasure. That is Tristan Nielsen, Abbotsford Canucks forward, and again, from Fort St. John in BC. And as I mentioned, you know, 3 years with the Vancouver Giants to wrap up his WHL career, goes right from the Vancouver Giants to the Abbotsford Canucks. So he's played a lot of hockey in the Lower Mainland, in the Fraser Valley specifically, out in Langley and Abbotsford. And now getting to go on another deep playoff run with a BC team. So special opportunity for Tristan Nielsen. And interesting to hear him just basically say, yeah, we just force guys to be like us, to get with the program. They come in and they immediately have to get with the program.
Yeah, whatever it takes, you know?
Absolutely.
Like, I think it's that simple sometimes. Whatever it takes to get everyone on the same page and to get after it, I mean, that's what it takes. You know, I don't think that's altogether that different from what it's probably like to show up and be on a team with Matthew Tkachuk on it, you know? And I think it shows. I think honestly, if we're being real, if we're being honest with ourselves, I think we've known watching this Canucks team play the last few years that's been hit and miss.
Yeah.
Right? Like at the NHL level, you know, you've been able to see the seams of a group where that energy is not consistent, where it can flag, where, you know, when the good times are rolling and the reinforcement is positive, this team can look pretty good. And when things go badly, there's sort of not that will to arrest it, that collective digging in, that foxhole mentality that you kind of need when your backs are up against the wall.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we've seen that too. Like, you can tell, you can't fake it, especially when it comes to relatively intelligent hockey markets. I mean, you know, you know it. You're going to know it when you play it, as the dead Prez once said.
Would love to be able to transport some of that, whatever's going right on that category in Abbotsford, to the Vancouver Canucks. Like, that's something that needs to make the trip down Highway 1 from Abbotsford to Vancouver in a big way. By the way, a lot of people noting that someone finally got caught by the classic Drance pregnant pause before asking a question. I will say that was a bit of a miscommunication on our part. That was longer than a standard Drance pause.
I think like it was my fault.
That was a really stretched out one.
I thought you were rapping. That's my bad.
That was a miscommunication behind the scenes. Don't worry. That was not a normal Drance pause. Anyways, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. You can send your thoughts in. And before we went to break a couple of segments ago, you brought up the idea of rethinking, or at least not necessarily throwing it out, but being willing to rethink and interrogate kind of the whole idea that we're viewing this Canucks offseason through, which is Project Keep Quinn Hughes Happy, right? Like, is that even the most productive, best way to increase the Canucks' chances of winning the Stanley Cup? And I think it is a very fair question. And to be fair, it's one that's come in to the inbox, I would say fairly regularly. Like, what the heck? Are they really going to sell off all of these futures and 15th overall for the faint hope of keeping Quinn Hughes happy, when even if you do, you know, go make a bunch of deals and get Marco Rossi and, you know, player X and player Y on top of that, you're probably still not a legitimate Stanley Cup contender, right? So it's like, you're going to spend all of these assets, get these guys, still probably not be a contender, and then still have the uncertainty about Quinn Hughes' future on top of that. You lay it out like that, and I do understand where the fans are coming from and why it's at least worth asking the question. I was thinking about it in the break since you brought it up, and I do think, fundamentally, unless you have inside knowledge or some sort of indication from Quinn Hughes that, like, hey, guys, this probably isn't happening, I don't think you can give up on trying to convince that player to stay unless you know it's out of the question. So I think that's kind of foundational thing one for me. And I think the other thing is, I get the whole idea of, well, let's not sell the future because Quinn Hughes might leave anyways. I think another element here is there's only so much hedging you can do around Quinn Hughes leaving your organization. You know what I mean? It's like, that is, if that happens, if that comes to pass, that's a devastating blow to your franchise, whether or not you traded this year's 15th overall pick. Like, the 15th overall pick this year is not dramatically changing your future if Quinn Hughes decides to go play in New Jersey with his brothers. You're kind of hooped either way at that point. You're kind of starting from scratch either way. Would you prefer to have it? Yeah, sure. But only it's marginal. It's not completely changing the trajectory of your franchise from that point. So I think those two things factored in together, that he's just so talented that you kind of need to go all out to try to keep him in your organization. And if he leaves, you're kind of hooped either way, at least for the foreseeable future. I think it's a fair question, but I still end up coming around to just go all out and do what you can to keep him.
Yeah. So I think my issue with your argument, the reason I disagree with your argument is that I would beseech you in response to expand your imagination.
All right.
You know, we're not talking 15th overall.
That. Okay.
We're not talking 15th overall. We're talking 15th overall plus one of the top two or three prospects in this organization, plus, you know, maybe another young player like a Hoglander caliber guy, plus maybe the 2026 first round pick, lottery protected. I mean, because here's the thing, like you get one guy, right? So you get one guy, you get, you know, you're one of your Zacha, Zegras, Rossi tier guys.
Yep.
Okay. You still need another, you know, and if you get the right fit, I mean, if you get Rossi, right. And then you also like, say you get Rossi and the opportunity presents itself to also get Zacha. You know, say the cost on Rossi is that 2026 first lottery protected. Okay. And then, but you can get Zacha for 15 plus, you know, one other piece, you know, now you're staring down the barrel of like, okay, say we do this, we can roll with something, you know, Jake DeBrusque and Pettersson on the top line, and we'll hold an open audition for third line right wing, and Philip Hedel and, you know, say Nils Hoglander and Kiefer Sherwood. And like, there's enough sort of dogs in the pool with a chance to be able to play that role, right? Whoever doesn't win that job plays with Rossi on sort of a second line. And then you've got Dakota Joshua with Garland and Zacha, you know, as a pretty nails third line. I mean, an engine of your team quality third line, probably getting Tufts too, right? Okay, now with this defense core, I mean, we're starting to cook. But if it comes at the expense of like two of your next three first round picks, I mean, you know, you've got a stew going in terms of a quality team, but is that stew like, are you competing with Florida with that?
No.
Are you competing with Edmonton? Are you competing with Dallas next year? Maybe if they move Robertson. But I just think like you start pushing in, right? You start pushing in and you get the one piece that you're going to need to trade for, right? And then it's like, okay, you know, Matt Duchene, 34-year-old, 4-year deal times 7.5 to 8 million, right? Like trading multiple firsts. I mean, some of the surgery required sort of does tip you into a spot where, yeah, I mean, Hughes might go even if you do those things.
Yep.
Like if you do those things, and if you sort of sacrifice more future, do you just sort of elongate the runway on the back end where you're trying to get back to where this team, you know, that had hoped to be for the last 5 years and kind of never really arrived at least never really arrived consistently at. You know, I think the organization would tell you, like, we're going to get back to being what we were in 2023, 2024. This season was an outlier. But the slingshot experience that we've had observing this team, it's like, no, that's not an outlier. This is what this team does. They take a step forward, they take a step back, because the truth is that when their goaltending and finishing luck is there, they look great for small stretches of games, but they've never been an elite team. This core has never emerged as an elite group core. They've had individual players have elite seasons or emerge as elite players in Quinn Hughes' case. But, you know, it just feels like a huge swing, you know, one with significant downside and one that guarantees nothing. So, I mean, I do think there's a weighting here that needs to be sort of looked at pretty sternly. I mean, the sort of path that I just laid out, for example, I mean, I do think that would be costly in terms of this team's overall positioning, especially in the event that, you know, you do it all and end up in kind of the same spot, but now with like an older roster where the incentive becomes, okay, well, we have to, Hughes doesn't want an extension, we've got to make a trade. Let's look for something that's a little more win now, a little more Tkachuk to Florida for Huberto and Uyghur, which is another thing that sort of, I think is a dangerous game for a team to play, especially given what you can accomplish, you know, with futures in mind and sort of a wider angle view that arguably this team should have been taking for much of the last 6 years to bolster the position that they'd be in now.
Yeah. So the idea of, okay, if you go all in now, you're more likely to kind of screw up and make a win now trade if you do have to trade Quinn Hughes. Like, that to me, that's not necessarily an argument against trying to go all in and make the team good. Like, that's a different decision. You know what I mean? And maybe they make the wrong decision then, but it's not written in stone that you have to do that. You know what I mean? Like, that, I don't think you can hold that argument against the idea of going all in now, but I do think you make some good points about the downside. And to me, this is where it really comes down to, and this is something you brought up earlier as well, the term, because I think the idea of spending your futures and going all in this summer, it's not to build a Stanley Cup contender next season or even the year after that, because the odds of that are really slim. What you're doing is buying yourself time by continuing to have Quinn Hughes on your team for a long term, right? Like, at least 6 more years down the road to give yourself time to figure it out. That's, to me, what you're buying more than anything. So I agree with you. If it's like, oh, Quinn Hughes is going to sign a 2-year extension with us and you've just spent all of these futures, that's a really tough spot to be in. But if the cost of, hey, we got to improve enough and show enough of a path forward so we can get an 8-year extension with Quinn Hughes, I think you do that, because that buys you the time to figure out other paths to contention, right? Like, that, I don't know what it's going to look like, but at least you're going to have multiple kicks of the can.
So what, but it's all sort of related, because we're talking about a risk profile, right? It's almost an actuarial exercise, Jamie,
yeah.
Right? It's like, you know, at a 30% likelihood of getting Hughes signed long term, what sort of,
yes, yeah,
future position are you willing to jettison? At a 60%, what are you willing to?
It's the variable, right? It's the likelihood. That's what it all comes down to, is how likely do you really think it is? And everyone's going to have a different answer to that. You know, some people are going to say, oh, it's already done. Like, don't even try, because it's written in stone that he's leaving. Other people are going to say, oh, it's all overblown. He's going to stay.
But I think that's okay. In some ways, it's like, if you're talking 0%, then it's like, okay, well, let's take one last kick at the can while we've got one of the best skaters in hockey.
Well, then you know what you should do. Yeah.
Yeah. In some ways, a 0% to me raises sort of the, like, incentive to push in. You know, it's the like, if I think my chances of getting Hughes locked up long term are at 80%, then I think you take a longer view. You know, so it's like,
well,
in some ways,
but it's 80% if you add a bunch of pieces. This, right, that's the rub. If you just think it's 80% if we don't do anything, if we stand pat, then it's like, okay, well, that's great. Then stand pat. Then take the long view.
Well,
you know what I mean?
If it's 80%, if I add some pieces, then I'll add some pieces, but I have to, like, then it's a conversation and an education, and it's a plan, and you're laying out a plan, and you're
right,
getting buy-in, and you're explaining the process, and like, hey, look, like, we think we can be a playoff team next year for sure. But, you know, that this is probably not going to be our window. This is how we're viewing our window. We need this and this and this to happen. Like, Pettersson needs to bounce back, Demko, blah, blah, blah. You know, like, then you're laying out a plan. If it's 80%, I feel like the more likely you think it is that he departs, in some ways, the more you should be looking at this as like, you know, a golden opportunity with the best defenseman in franchise history that you may never have again. In some ways, this, like, the lower the percentage goes, the greater the incentive to be a little reckless in mm-hmm. some ways, James.
Well, and again, I don't have a problem with that, because I think what a lot of this comes down to, and you make the point, you know, it's not just 15th overall, but like, my appetite in a post Quinn Hughes world for like talking ourselves into building around like a Lekkomäki, Volander, and whoever they would pick with 15th, like Victor Eklund, and then whoever they'd pick at like 14th in 2026. Like, I don't have a lot of appetite for that. I'm not that interested in that. I think, and hey, I could be wrong here, that if Quinn Hughes leaves, it's going to be like a much deeper and slower building process than just, well, hey, we've got this new core of guys that we drafted in the last few years, and we're going to build around them. So I don't have a problem going all in, even if you think Quinn Hughes is going to leave, as you said, taking one last kick at it. Because again, I just think a building block of this conversation for me is, like, however difficult you think it's going to be to rebuild in the wake of Quinn Hughes, double that. You know what I mean? So, like, anything that's like, well, we got to set ourselves up for after Quinn Hughes leaves, it's like, good luck with that. You know, like, oh, we'll get Bowen Byram as our Quinn Hughes replacement. It's like, that's not going to work. And I like Bowen Byram as a player, but there is no Quinn Hughes replacement unless you're trading for Cale Makar. And even then, you're not like, well, we'll get our Quinn Hughes insurance in the door. No, you won't. That's not happening.
Yeah, think about how flawed this team has regularly looked across the last 4 or 5 years, and now consider that, you know, they've been outscored by a massive margin
this
in
is
most
what I'm
of
saying.
Those seasons in non-use minutes, right? I mean, like, the extent to which he's disguised some of the structural flaws on this roster over the years, you know, it can't be overstated, right? Yeah. I mean, it is – there's a reason that I think his truer comparison is not Makar and Haskinen, but is – McDavid and some of the best two-way centermen in the league, right? I mean, it's a totally different sport in the minutes he plays and the minutes he doesn't. And if all of the Canucks minutes are minutes without Quinn Hughes, oh boy.
Yeah,
I think you're going to realize pretty quickly just how far away this team is from, you know, an accelerated rebuild. I'm just saying, I'm readying myself emotionally, Jamie, because, like, I know that I don't want to be in a spot where I'm, like, shocked by it, you know, where I'm like, where that adds to it. Where it's like, yeah, you know, it really is unfortunate that that things have turned out this way, but we really believe that we can get this back on track quickly in the wake of, you know, like, that's the moment that's going to be painful for me.
It's going to be tough.
And for a lot of Canucks fans, I think, by the way.
The win now, if there's a win now Quinn Hughes trade, like, that's going to be a really, really tough one to deal with. I just hope it doesn't happen while we're live on air. Next time.
100%.
All right. Thank you for everyone listening and texting in today. As I mentioned earlier in the show, no show tomorrow. I believe we're playing a Jays game. So we're going to try to do our normal Wednesday business on Thursday. Hopefully we can get the crossover. We can get Buchla going on Thursday. And no show Friday either. So one more show this week on Thursday. It'll be game 4 of the Stanley Cup Finals that day. So lots to get into. Have a great couple days. We're back on Thursday for more Canucks Talk. Sportsnet 650.